Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, Season 8C, Chats Adams. My name is Magellan, and the threat to this podcast does not come from Paris. It comes from within. It's Alan.
Whoa. The Paris is coming from inside the house? I think this works. Looks at hand, realizes notes have been smudged for a long time. Wait a minute, blurst!
And somehow we do the meme with the astronauts with the gun. And it's like it was always
has been.
It's always Paris, or I'll always remember Paris, but that's the Casablanca guy now. Behind the
astronaut. Disastrous. Catastrophic.
That's how I do memes. That's my meme.
I just kind of fall into them, and then I put a picture at the end of
it. That's good. That's actually good. It's the astronaut, but it's Humphrey Bogart. And it says, instead of we'll always have Paris, it's... Paris always has
been. It's always been Paris? Always has been.
Something like that.
I came up with a good meme recently, Magellan.
Okay, I'd love to hear it.
It was the Predator hands shaking meme, and on the left side was United States historians, and on the right side was Formula One fans, and the middle was fuck Hamilton. Because Lewis Hamilton's like the guy who wins. Oh, it's really esoteric and annoying, but Lewis Hamilton's like one of the drivers for Mercedes in Formula One, and he wins all the races ever. Mm. And most people who actually care, I mean, he's talented, but it's fun to dunk on him. Just like Hamilton, in a lot of ways, was talented, but oh boy, are we going to dunk on him today?
Yeah, for sure.
Oh baby,
for sure. So, speaking of Hamilton and historians and dunking, you are listening to a podcast that covers the HBO miniseries John Adams, 2 episodes a week, except for next week when we only have one left, unfortunately. And this time we watched episodes 5 and 6 of John Adams. The first episode, episode 5, is called Unite or Die. And like all of the episodes of this miniseries, it was based on the 2001 biography of John Adams by David McCullough, written for screen by Kirk Ellis and directed by Tom Hooper. This particular episode, episode 5, originally aired on April 6th, 2008. Alan, what happened in Unite or Die?
Well, Magellan, elected America's first vice president, Adams is frustrated by his exclusion from Washington's inner circle. I don't even know if that's true. He also sees his friendship with Jefferson, the Secretary of State, strained by the British-French conflict. Though he's vilified for casting an unpopular saving vote in the Senate that ratifies a U.S.-British treaty, Adams ends up being elected president in 1796. Huh.
So the episode opens... Just to kind of get into it here. What do you think about it overall first? I'm curious about that.
Of the two, I definitely like this one a lot more because we centered Hamilton and his conflict with Adams. And also, like, in this point of their life, you feel like Adams, Jefferson, Hamilton, all of these men are in a lot of ways defined by their relationships to each other. And that's really solidified in this one effectively. I think this episode actually serves as a really cool companion piece to the musical Hamilton, which I'm sure we're going to be referencing a decent amount here, but definitely a very different portrayal of everybody's favorite immigrant, American immigrant.
Right. Yeah. That'll be fun.
But I liked it. I thought overall this one was fairly engaging, and like, you know, even this late in his life, in this point in his life, Adams is still... meeting new people and like these new players in the political theater of America.
Yeah, so. Definitely. I think it is. It's certainly a much different approach to this stretch of time than the musical Hamilton. And I think it is fun to have the perspective of someone who's like an insider, but an outsider of these like big foundational events. And that really is kind of what this episode is about, is that Adams is on the periphery of these early crises during the Washington administration. And he also, a big point that's made, you know, at the beginning and the end of the episode, is that Adams just also has an outsider perspective on everything because he's been serving as a diplomat in Europe for so long. And he starts the episode talking to Congress, being like, hey, here are a couple suggestions for titles that we could call the president, okay? You guys tell me what you like. We could go with His Excellency. How about His Majesty? How about the coolest guy in the whole country? And we love him. And everyone's like, how about you suck?
How about suck my ass?
How about rotundity? His rotundity?
One too many jokes about Adams being a fat guy in this episode. Just one too many.
Yeah.
But I'm sure he did actually deal with that. He got a lot of insults throughout his life.
Yeah. They did not pull punches, those guys.
Yeah.
So he has this idea of like the presidency needs to have all of this power, and like the way for it to have power is to have a sort of like regal air to it. And he's like, you know, obsessed with this idea of central authority and how to secure it and all that stuff. But also at the same time, he's in this office, the vice presidency, which is like basically nothing. Like, what is the vice president responsible for, really? You're just supposed to sit and listen to the Senate talk, and if they can't decide something, then you decide it for them.
Literally, there are rules against you talking. It's fascinating that he's like, wow, I'm like the biggest talker in the world. He kind of, once again, is acknowledging his arrogance in front of Abigail. He's like, I love talking, and I took the job that means that I legally can't speak until they let me. This sucks. Yeah. I want to talk. I want to be chatty.
It's interesting because in this stretch of time during the Washington administration, I talk with students a lot about the unwritten constitution, which is sort of like, okay, we wrote this document that has like a framework of how the US government is supposed to work, but then we actually see rubber hit the road in these first few years of the nation, and we have to figure out like, how does this work? Like, there's no rules really in the constitution for how does a Senate meeting work exactly. And you know, I was imagining, like, what if the vice president had been someone more likable and more charismatic as the first vice president? Like, if Thomas Jefferson or someone who people, like, liked had been the first vice president, maybe the vice presidency would be a totally different role than it is today. But because it's this guy, Adams, who, like, everyone's like, shut up. We don't want to listen to you talk.
We're making it a rule that you have to be quiet. And now that rule is going to carry on to the future.
Yeah. And you have to wonder if part of that is just about the personalities involved, and more so than it is about, like, how the role should be.
It really gives me a lot of pause thinking about stuff like that, and a lot of, I guess, worry maybe that so much of, in general, not just in America, but like political theater and political positions like this are decided by, you know, deeply flawed individuals who are making like wide spanning decisions about the dude from science class who they think is a huge nerd and they want to dump on him. And it's like, well, now there's right. rules that nobody can be science.
Yeah, right. There's so much personal stuff involved in all this.
Yeah.
And then there's this moment where Adams is like, ugh, he has this line about the vice presidency where he's like, the role of vice president is the most insignificant office ever devised by the mind of man. So he's just, you know.
Every once in a while, though, they put lines in this where I'm like, this is for us today. Like, I'm sure, like, that's obviously relevant to what he's saying, but that's also like, you know, that and all the different jokes about Washington's teeth where I'm like, I get it. Like, I know this because I read a history. Like,
yeah.
This is for like the people who took first grade history class. What are you saying?
Yeah, like when they're eating dinner together and Washington's like, ow, my teeth. I have fake teeth.
I have fake. Hey, did you guys know? And it's as if he were to like go outside and be like, hold on, I gotta go chop down a tree, and then like a cherry falls off of a branch. You're like, I know, guys.
Yeah. Right. So that's kind of like the table setting of the political side of things, and we can talk more about that in a bit. I'm curious about your feelings about the John Adams's personal life, and especially the character of Abigail Adams and like where she's at in these two episodes.
I was really disappointed. Well, so I was disappointed starting last week when, you know, after that wonderful like reunion scene in episode 4, Abigail already starts to fall back into the like person who misses John, cares about him, and pushes him to be better. That's always been what Abigail's character was about at its core. But she also, like, in the first couple episodes had so much interiority and independence and plot lines that didn't have to do with John, and was using him in a way to sort of manipulate the government towards this women's rights agenda, like all this great stuff. And now, what is Abigail Adams' role besides to smile and to stay and to be polite in bed as John worries about the country and right. to be happy when he takes more power and to make sure that he knows to call himself president. It's like,
right.
you know, it's not a flanderization of her character, I think. It's just sort of a flattening more so, mm-hmm. where it feels like we got the thing that's useful about her character and that's all we're going to do with her from now on.
Yeah, it's sort of like like you're saying, she settled into her position in his life. And since this is ultimately like his story, they're not as interested in exploring that relationship anymore, which is a bummer because I think that there's a lot that they could be talking about with their kids and with how he feels about his job and stuff. And we just don't really see that. And we, for a lot of both of these episodes, have to infer how Abigail Adams is feeling based on like the looks that Laura Linney is giving people.
Yes, yes.
Which she does a great job, but you know, when it's like, don't worry, I know that you feel exactly the way that John Adams feels, and she just has to furrow her brow like it's like, okay, this is not what I was looking for.
Exactly.
Also, her wig is just not good.
It's all over the place. On some scenes it's like, this just looks like her hair, and then others it's like, that's fake. What is that? What is this terrible looking wig? I know it's a wig, even in like historically it's a wig, but still, yeah. Like, yeah, not all wigs are very good.
Yeah.
John gets all the good wigs in these episodes.
Right. So that's kind of where we're at with the family. We get some other family stuff later. The big thing is that like a secretary guy says, hey, I really want to marry your daughter. And Paul Giamatti does this like,
so it's amazing. The glance.
Yeah. It's almost like he's in the office or something. Like he does a total yeah. like head snap. What did you say?
Mr. Smith is the biggest trash man. Two apparent episodes full of trash men is like top three easily. This is, again, where I was like, oh, Moriarty. Yeah, that's him. That's him doing that, like, kind of slimy thing. Because, you know, he's asking John for all this stuff. And from the beginning, when he's like, John's doing his work. And then he's like, yeah, and I wanted to ask you something. And he's like, yeah, whatever. And then he's like, I wanted to ask you if I could marry your daughter. Shing! Like, 45-degree Giamatti. That's as if, like, his actual real-life daughter came on set and was like, Dad, I'm pregnant. Like, what?
Yeah, he really sold it. You don't think that he's a good guy, this guy? This, like, yeah.
I mean, I generally think neglectful parents, like, that's a pretty awful thing. And we're seeing, like, that generational trauma kind of go throughout this family. Sort of an undiscussed side plot, but... The years that Abigail and John spent in France did a number on their children, and now most of, if not all their children, pretty much except John Quincy, are dealing with like extremely difficult marriages on whatever ends of it.
Yeah, he ends up being pretty shitty in the second episode, where he's like, "Hey, I'm just gonna leave Nabby and the children with you and go be gone for like months and years," but. Right now, when he's asking to propose,
yeah, this is more like what you're watching. John just get stuck in his ways more and more and more.
Yeah, he's kind of being a jerk.
The second like scene in this episode is Abigail being like, "Why are you fighting with everyone? You're not going to get anything you want if you're going to keep starting arguments and fights. Like, you just need to to let go a little bit, just one time." John Adams is definitely painted in this episode as a guy who. Well, understood, like read the right books, and it's like, all right, I guess I'm just right about everything. Why would I ever be wrong? Don't correct me on anything. Which is why he desperately needs somebody like Abigail.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's definitely the painted as the negative one here. I didn't mean to suggest that. It's just that I like when I think about Smith in these, it's like he goes on to just be awful.
Yeah, he reveals himself to be very shitty later. So there's like a marriage, and then we have another.
So quick. We're through this so fast.
And then we have another scene at the table where like the parents have to shit on their kids some more. And it's.
Well, because he's like, I'm going to go to London. And like, you guys literally just got married. He's like, yeah, but stocks. And then John says something along the lines of like, you know, stocks are like, you're playing with other people's money and gambling with other people's money. Why can't you just earn your own money? Like my kids who are all successful, which he eats a lot of crow on that later. But you know, there's that perspective, especially in this early era of speculation, that uh-huh. it is not honest work at all. It's work for the lazy. It's work for the gambling.
Yeah.
It's still definitely viewed as like illegal gambling. I think that's why that stigma still exists today.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of talk of like, yeah, he's speculating. And then I think Charles does some speculating too or something. Yeah. And it undoes both of them. And meanwhile, JQA is just like handsome.
Handsome, chilling. Aging well. At one point, yeah. John announces that he's going to become the ambassador to the Netherlands. And who does he choose to bring with him? Is that his brother-in-law or one of his like youngest brothers? I couldn't tell who that
it's guy one of is. His younger brothers, I think.
And yeah, I think you're right. And because he's like, yeah, if you're going to leave me for years and years, at least I'll take like a sibling with me to not split the family up even more. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, you're so great for a man of 27. And I'm like, this guy's the ambassador to Netherlands at 27. I can't even tie my shoes.
Yeah, right. So yeah, that's the home stuff, at least in this episode. And then it kind of blows up in the next one. We can talk about that. But then the main, I guess, kind of the main meat of this first episode is what's going on in Washington's cabinet and how that kind of represents these larger diplomatic problems, economic problems, disagreements between different factions in American politics. So you've got George Washington, who just in every scene he's in is so tired. And
he's always tired. David Moore is playing it like he's been up for the last 24 hours. Always.
Yeah. And then the big players are, you have Thomas Jefferson as the Secretary of State, recently returned from France. And he likes to talk about, oh, I was in revolutionary France and they were listening to my ideas and they're having a revolution and it's the best thing ever.
Vive la France.
Yeah, right. And then you have Alexander Hamilton, who's Secretary of the Treasury. And he's that guy who's like the bad guy in everything.
Rufus Sewell. He's the bad guy in A Knight's Tale, which Chats alum in a way.
Right. Yeah, that's what it was. He was the bad guy in A Knight's Tale. And he's Hamilton. And Hamilton in this is just kind of like a smarmy guy who loves money and loves war, which is, I think, maybe a better depiction of Hamilton than the musical, perhaps.
Yeah, the comparisons, it has to be made, because like both of these series paint the other person as like a tertiary side character who doesn't matter in the slightest to my life.
Yeah,
because in Hamilton, you know, there's like John Adams does not even appear physically in Hamilton the musical at all. Mm-hmm. They reference him, they talk about him, and they like make fun of him a lot. And they make a joke about like the Adams administration is like such a ghastly time for American history, but you know that historically did not be entirely his fault. And so from the John Adams TV series perspective, Hamilton is not portrayed as like this cartoon evil stupid villain. He's just like really greedy, really aggressive, and really corrupt.
Yeah,
like right. Fully embracing the power that he's being given. There's so many people who whisper into John's ears like, you know, you have power now and you're a president now, you can do so many things, your highness, your majesty. And he's like, I don't need that. I think like from his letters it's weird to understand that these two like legitimately did really hated each other.
Yes, I believe so. Yeah.
But you know, it's such a different perspective, and it's such a fascinating thing about biography in general, is like the lens you choose to take can literally influence how people view history.
Right.
Because I know, you know, so many people watch Hamilton and like you shout along to the parts where they dunk on John Adams, and we have the clip in this where King George makes fun of, calls out like
John Adams.
But in this, it's like he's just trying, like he's just Paul Giamatti. He's doing his best. Be nice to him. So I just think that perspective change is really refreshing and interesting.
Yeah, and it also like it makes sense because there are sort of moments of triumph the other person wasn't present for, like
yeah,
when John Adams was doing all of his Declaration stuff and in the Continental Congress, Hamilton was not there. He was a soldier at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Hamilton is like playing a big role in the Constitutional Convention and all that, Adams is off in England. So it makes sense that they would look at each other like, you're not legit. You're not part of this.
You're not doing anything here.
Yeah. Just for some historical context of like the big the big issues. So another line that definitely feels like it's for modern people is when Adams is talking to that random dude and he's like, I guess we're called the Federalists now. I guess those guys are the Republicans.
Like, that's what the factions are.
I guess this is what everybody believes. But the two political parties that are emerging during this time are the Federalists, who have been called the Federalists for a while. They first got that name when they were in support of ratifying the Constitution, and they're called the Federalists because they believe in a stronger federal government, which is what the Constitution was meant to do, in contrast with the previous national government, the Articles of Confederation. And the Federalists, like Hamilton, he explains to Jefferson, like, I have this great idea for assuming state debt and establishing a national bank, and here's my plan.
Such a dark scene, by the way.
Yeah.
Where he's like, if you want people to trust us, we need to have debt. How do you get debt? Well, you ask for it. And if we make the states ask for it from us, then they owe us. And then the rest of the other countries of the world are going to be like, wow, all these states owe you debt. And then Jefferson's like, isn't debt a form of control and like monarchy in a way? And he's like, yeah. And
that's okay.
That's okay. I think that's fine. We can model other countries who do stuff like that. That's fine. We get money at the end of it.
Yeah. And so the Federalists definitely are accused. We see that the accusation levied at Adams a few times that he's like a monarchist. But the Federalists are certainly in favor of stronger central authority. They're interested in mimicking British systems. And they end up being the party who's kind of like, yeah, we fought the revolution just so that we could be in charge. Not necessarily because the British system was bad. We just wanted our own version of it. And then on the other side of that, you have a group that calls themselves the Republicans or the Democratic Republicans. That's Jefferson. James Madison is another prominent Republican who used to be a Federalist, actually. And the Republicans generally are in favor of stronger state control as opposed to federal control. They are not so into this like central bank thing. The Republicans are more of a southern party, and so they're kind of in favor of a more agrarian nation driven by plantation agriculture as like the central economic force of the country. And then maybe you could also say that the Republicans are more like the party of the people, although I think maybe that's more like their self-styling as opposed to actual fact.
100%.
But Jefferson definitely wants to paint himself as like the project of the American Revolution was an anti-monarchist project that should spread across the world. And so that's why he's like pro. So one like big divisive issue ends up being the French Revolution and what the U.S. is going to do about it. And you have Jefferson being like, we should help them. We should fight with them. They're a revolution just like ours. But also in that he's like, and by the way, I'm a huge celebrity over there and everybody loves me. And I like help them write their thing. And then you have Hamilton being like, no, let's not. Or like maybe even let's join the British and help them stop this revolution, so that we don't have like the forces of mobocracy in the United States. So that's kind of where we're at historical context wise.
Excellent. I mean, and then I think that the final sort of nail in the coffin of this series negative portrayal of Hamilton is that Benjamin Rush confides to Adams that somebody may have plotted against him receiving enough votes in the first election. And we're kind of like left with that mystery hanging in the background. I honestly forgot about it because there's so much going on here. Mm-hmm. And then right when things start to really be boiling up, Rush comes back again and it's like, yeah, it was totally Hamilton. He's the reason you lost the election. Mm. And it doesn't, I think it's kind of cool how it doesn't blow up into like a big fight scene. There were multiple moments in both of these episodes where I was like, if this wasn't this type of series, these men would have been punching each other in the face if they didn't have decorum the way that they do. Like, multiple scenes where I'm like, why are you not killing each other?
Well, and you know, some people at this time did kill each other over things like this and duels and stuff. And
Hamilton, Aaron Burr, sir,
dies in a duel. So,
yeah,
yeah. So, I'm curious what you thought about all this like French stuff and what your thinking was about like what the United States should do, because it's like not an easy choice.
it's an incredibly difficult decision, I'm sure, for them at the time to be like, well, we like, it's just the logic, like follow the logic of it, right? They're like, okay, a big reason we won the Revolutionary War is because the French helped us. We mm-hmm. spent literally, we had like delegates go there for years. We love the French. We love the rich French. And now the, you know, the lower class or whatever is like rebelling against the people that we worked with. But our treaty to like help them in return was with the country of France. So mm-hmm. whoever wins is the person we have to help. So I guess we're helping the rebels who take over. I guess we're part of this now. And like, do we involve, how much can we involve ourselves? And what Washington is saying is basically how little can we involve ourselves? Because we don't have the warriors, the soldiers to fight this. Mm-hmm. We don't have the money to fight this. We're still new. Like, America is trapped in this position where we got so much help and now we already have to pay it back much sooner than we thought we would.
Right.
It's frustrating. And I know, like, you know, culturally what it manifests as is the anti-French sentiment amongst the United States, as well as people saying that Jefferson may as well have been a French man because the way he mm-hmm. Went there and visited for so long that they kind of like disavowed him of his like United States-ness, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's incredibly, incredibly difficult. But I think, you know, as it becomes more of a conflict that they can't avoid, I think the responses get is where you find the political meat of this episode.
Yeah, definitely. I was sort of intrigued by, this is like a little side story that I had not fully understood before, but the whole Genet guy, diplomat guy who shows up, and it's called the Citizen Genet affair, and I like knew the name from, you know, a vocabulary list or something, or maybe I read it in my textbook when I was in high school. But essentially what it is there's this diplomat from Revolutionary France who comes to the US like, hey, can you help us out? But before he shows up in the capital, he like takes a detour and just goes around and riles people up and tries to see if he can sign Americans up to fight for the French. And then he shows up and he's talking with Washington, and Washington's like, yeah, we've decided to be neutral. And he's like, what the fuck, guys, you can't do
that. Washington has to also be like, you can't do that anymore. We need our Americans to be here. Stop taking people.
Right. And so he ends up having this great line by the end of the scene where he's like, the people are with me. And then he's like, you will hear from me again, sir. And then I will speak to you with a million voices. And then you will obey. And then he pieces out. And the whole
time. Yeah,
oh, go ahead.
No, just like being a French revolutionary at the time, you read so much stuff about like the plurality of voices and the plurality of revolution that mm-hmm. I'm sure that just comes naturally to the dude. That's like, yeah, this is what I say when people fuck with me, is I tell them that I have a million men. I have a million of their men on my side.
Yeah, that's definitely this like vaunted revolutionary language. And then mm-hmm. Jefferson totally is in the back, like, you know, when you meet when you introduce your friend from one friend group to the other friend group and they don't get along, and he's like, oh,
no.
God. Oh, this is going so badly. He's like biting his thumb or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It was funny.
Not enough credit goes to the guy playing Jefferson in these episodes.
He plays him really subdued. It's an interesting performance.
All of these guys could be portrayed as so ridiculous and have in other media. Not even just Hamilton, but like in different films. I'm trying to remember who the actor is who plays him, though, because he's... you know, taking on a more and more and more important role. Stephen Delane mm-hmm. Is the guy. I think, yeah, he's just really great and brings that, like, humanity and groundedness to Jefferson, even though he's such a controversial figure.
Yeah, I think it's a great portrayal. So we have that business. It ends up being that Washington actually asks for Adams's advice because Jefferson and Hamilton fight so much. And he's like, come on, buddy, let's have dinner. And that's the dinner where his teeth don't work. And this basically seems to be implying that it was Adams's idea to have a proclamation of neutrality, which, again, I don't know how accurate that is or if it's just a sort of narrative convenience that he's the one that proposes it. But mm-hmm. that ends up being what the U.S. goes with. Then there's this whole thing with, like, they send John Jay to make a treaty with Britain, and it's, like, too nice to Britain, and everyone's like, oh, we're so mad. And you have people rioting outside of George Washington's house or, you know, wherever he conducts his business. And I thought that this was an interesting way to frame the end of Washington's presidency, because you know, I think how it's taught a lot of the time, and certainly how I've taught it before, is like, yeah, and after 8 years, he was just like, yeah, that seems like long enough. I'm out of here. And it's this like noble thing for him to step down from the presidency and not continue on for his life. And Abigail Adams even says that too, of like, what a noble thing he's doing. But really, he's also doing it because it just fucking sucks. And he doesn't want to be president anymore. He's miserable. And he's like, John, I can't do this anymore. I'm done, dude. And it also kind of gives this interpretation where, you know, the reason that John Adams's presidency is so hard is because George Washington like leaves him all of these problems that he has to deal with.
And that's historically one of the things about the presidency, right? Is it's like such a vaunted position, especially now. People want to be president, but in this series, we're going to see at least three, and eventually, I think by the last episode, into the sixth presidency. From the beginning, it is not a position that people actually enjoy having. I think there's value in it, and like there are important things to be done in that position, but it's handed off like a monkey's paw or like a cursed tome.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, all right, finally I'm free, your problem now, John, good luck.
Right.
And so like, yeah, just the way that this show portrays what being president actually means and doesn't glorify it in any way, but it's more like, yeah, you just have to like shoulder the burdens of an entire nation in its most difficult period.
Yeah.
Good luck. Everyone hates you also. Sorry, did I say that? Anyways, good luck.
Yeah. And just to skip ahead a tiny bit to the next big scene we'll talk about, when Adams is inaugurated and everyone's clapping for him, and then George Washington leans in and he's like, I am fairly out and you are fairly in. See which of us will be the happiest.
Right.
It's like, bro, what the fuck? Come on. Don't do that.
No, I just won. I just won.
Yeah, just let
and
me
now
feel
you're like
a little bit good.
Hey, heads up, this is gonna be the worst position for the rest of your life, and you're gonna dread it every second of it. Good luck.
Yeah.
Peaced out, mic dropped.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that scene, or do you have other stuff?
I think that's the last place to go, yeah.
So John Adams is elected president. He wins by, I think they say, 3 votes. It was fun listening to all the other people who ran. They're like Aaron Burr, 30 votes, and you're like, aw. He tried.
Yeah.
Jefferson is right behind Adams, and then Adams wins with 71 votes, I believe. And then the inauguration scene is such an intentional but effective contrast to Washington's from last week, where, you know, whereas Washington's was like, people are coming to the stands and standing on chairs, and we're trying to like know how to refer to him, and he's so powerful and soft spoken. John Adams's inauguration in this is like the saddest thing of the series, is the moment when he becomes president. And it's just very like, it's the moment where they count the votes, and he goes, and he's the one saying it, and he's like, 71 votes, John Adams. And he like sits back, and it's like, oh God, the curse is mine to bear now.
Yeah, right.
I'm trying to find my notes on this part, but you know, he has the part where he gets the handoff from Washington, who says like, see which of us will be the happiest.
Yeah.
Which is like really ghoulish for him. And he just doesn't seem ready for this. Like, you know, they're swearing him in, and as he's going up there, and Jefferson's like, Mr. you know, President, or Your Majesty, or whatever, and he's like, seriously, we just had this conversation, but call me John. Like, the beginning of the episode is him being like, what about Your Highness? And they're like, no, fuck that. And now he's like, please. Just please, John,
don't.
Is fine.
Please don't. Yeah. Right.
And then, yeah, he gives Washington this like glance when he says, like, see the which of us will be happiest line, where he's like, really? Me? No? Now? Okay. I guess I did. Yeah.
It's such a fascinating scene. To contrast with Washington's inauguration, because like we talked about last time, there's just this grand moment where there's the, you know, the throngs of people like, oh my God, our hero, Big George, yeah, we love him. And then Adams is among his people who were the crusty, you know, awful politicians constantly yelling about things. And he just wants for these guys to like finally respect him. And I think he honestly cares about that more than like the people who are basically invisible to him.
Like his whole mind, his whole experience exists within the cabinet.
Right.
And it's like, dude, there's your control. There's like a whole, there's people out there.
Right, exactly. But, you know, we see almost no contact between him and the people until the end of the second episode, which we'll talk about. But yeah, like when he announces the votes in the Senate and he's like, hey, John Adams with the most votes. And you see a bunch of dudes like roll their eyes like, fuck, this guy's going to be the dude. Ugh.
One guy claps, a bunch of people, instead of clapping, just smack their desks like, uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah.
And then there's that other moment where he's in the cabinet meeting before he gets kicked out by George Washington, and Hamilton and Jefferson are fighting. And then he kind of interjects like, hey, maybe you're both right. And he like rambles for a little while, and it cuts around to everybody at the table being like, ugh, he's talking right now. So his whole, and then Washington's like, okay, we have cabinet business. See you later. So the whole episode, you know, people in power just kind of dunking on him and not respecting him. And this is what he cares about, is these guys in this room. And he kind of does win them over. Like, it's a somewhat triumphant scene in that at first it's a little awkward, and the biggest claps are for when he talks about how cool George Washington is. But it's a classy move on his part. And then he kind of gets into the speech, and the camera starts doing close-ups on him, and the music swells, and it's like, wow, this guy can really talk. And he like almost has that moment where he's like, yes, they respect me as the orator and the lawyer guy that I am. But then, you know, he and Abigail get to the house, and it's been ransacked and emptied, and it's like time to deal with reality.
Right.
How this is really going to go.
The music actually like accents what you're talking about, where once he's like starting to win people over, they play that song, the Declaration of Independence is the name of it. It's the song we use as our break music actually for the podcast. Mm-hmm. And it's got such a good sweeping like 1-2-3 like staccato build. Mm-hmm. That I really, really love. And it's just like, yeah, you need to understand that this guy's like, he's nervous about it. It's scary. It's going to go really kind of badly, but we're going to try it. That's like the ultimate message of John Adams, I feel like. It's like, but we did it. We at least we took the stand.
Right.
Tried our best.
Right.
Yeah, I thought the scene was really impressive. And then, you know, this episode is shorter, but I still think it drags just in these last couple minutes where it's like, okay, just end it. And but then we get this scene that like you would write in a screenwriting class where they go back to their, I think it's their house, like Abigail and John's house.
The sense I got was it was the house that Washington was occupying.
Okay, because I wrote, was this the White House? And then I was like, no, that doesn't line up. The White House wasn't done being built yet.
Yeah, I think it's right. I think it's whatever the president's dwelling is in, if this is Philadelphia or New York. I can't remember where we're at this point.
Yeah, and this is their victory, right? Is they're like, we're here, what's, oh. And one of the enslaved people is like, yeah, they looted every single thing. All the sofas, all the furniture, all of the food,
the
it's
bedding,
all gone.
It's all, yeah, there's nothing here anymore.
And they still smile through it. Abigail's like, sure, this is our house now. Like, she's the one to, like, bring this positive note to it, where he wants to sit down on, like, the floor, sit on a chair. She's the one who's like, John, stand up. Like, help me clean up and stand up, John. Call yourself president and get up. And that's how we cut the episode. It's Abigail being the one who's like, this is another one of those, like, you know, Laura Linney just carries this scene. It's not even that, like, engaging from a script perspective, but she does. She performs it super well.
Yeah.
It's like, you have to do your job, dude. No one's going to do it for you. Come on.
Right.
Put the pants on.
Right.
I love it.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much Unite or Die. Did you have any other three notes from this one, Mister?
No, I think that's it. Let's get into that second one.
Sure. We'll be right back after this brief musical break to discuss Unnecessary War.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Chats Adams. The second episode we watched this week was John Adams, Episode 6, Unnecessary War. This one originally aired April 13th, 2008. Magellan, please take the summary reins for me so that my energy levels can plummet.
Okay, go to sleep. I'll read you this beautiful bedtime story.
Thank you.
In this episode, abandoned by Jefferson for retaining Washington's cabinet, President Adams holds firm on keeping the nation out of war, despite French aggression and pro-war sentiment among his advisors. Abigail urges him to sign the controversial Alien and Sedition Acts, seeing them as a way to preserve domestic security. Meanwhile, Adams faces a crisis at home.
That was so exciting that I woke up and I want to talk about it for 30 to 45 minutes.
No. Go back to sleep. Okay, good night. John Adams can't get to you. He doesn't exist.
He's not real.
Don't worry. Don't be scared.
All right, you have to guide the whole episode if you're going to go with this bit of me sleeping through it.
No, I'm not going with the bit.
Oh, whoa. Okay, the bit's over. Hello, guys.
No, thank you.
So this episode's super boring, if y'all can't tell. I thought it was the worst episode of the show so far. I was
definitely
bored throughout.
Agree.
You agree?
Yeah, you can finish your sentence.
Okay. I thought it was really slow. It's overlong. It's just doing way more of this checklist thing of like, here's all the things that happened in Adams' presidency. Yeah. Alien and Sedition Acts. Magellan shows the scene in his school. This is the reason that we watched this show is because of the scene. Oh, my God. What else? Hamilton, not even that interesting anymore. Jefferson and Adams, they're probably going to kiss before they die. Abigail, controversial. Charles, yeah, unfortunately, tragically dies. That's it. It's like so. It's just this. It's hitting every beat. Why? This is exhaustive.
Yeah, it definitely feels like this episode is trying. I mean, this is the downside of doing a biopic, is sometimes the person's life does not fit a narrative arc. Like John Adams, his presidency is equal parts like boring and subtle and like very sad. And so I don't know, just it's paced so strangely, and the takeaways here are kind of muddled, because ultimately like John Adams as a figure is sort of muddled and inconsistent. So it just ends up being a slog. And I agree, it was out of the episodes, I think it was the one I enjoyed the least, which is a bummer because I was kind of looking forward to like, oh, how are they going to do this and portray this? And I really thought they were going to do more with the Alien and Sedition Acts, but they just had a scene where they were like, here's what they are.
Here's the problem with them.
And it's like, here we go. Which I think is, you know, it's the problem of the story being the kind of top-down perspective of John Adams, is we don't ever see what's going on in the country. We don't see like the street level perspective, mm-hmm, of things the way that we did in the first episode when he was just like a lawyer in Boston. And we saw someone being tarred and feathered, and we saw the kind of lived reality of what was going on in the revolution. But now he's just hanging out in the White House, and he's hanging out in Congress, and he's hanging out with his wife, and we just don't see the effects that any of these things have anymore. So it ends up being a lot of like abstract talking about things as opposed to seeing things happen.
Yeah. And like there are some quote unquote things happening in this episode. I mean, like the Charles renouncement scene is huge and like really intense, and they're acting so upwards, whatever the term is for like acting a lot. That like going to the White House for the first time is like really cool. Like these are moments that are important historically and are interesting. But I mean, if there's any meat to this, it's watching Adams and watching Giamatti like play this like beleaguered president who is, mm-hmm, just being wasted away. At this point, he already has the like two shocks of hair on both sides of his head that like we historically know Adams to have had. Like this is like most images of John Adams. He, mm-hmm, looks like this. So like he's coming into this sort of presidential image that people, it's just like how, you know, in this episode, when they go to the White House, they see a painting of George Washington, and, mm-hmm, Adams looks at it and says, is he welcoming us in or showing us the door? And it's like, that is the image of Pete that people have just have always will have of Washington going forward. I thought it was, yeah, funny, by the way, that they clearly like either repainted or redrew part of that to make it look more like David Morris's Washington. They like changed.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, if you look at it, it's like not the original painting. They
edited
it to look more like him. Yeah,
that's stupid.
Yeah, it's, I understand why, but like, come on, I believe you that this is George Washington. I don't have to fall for that.
Yeah.
Like the family stuff is all well performed, but it's just a lot of misery. It's a very miserable episode. The presidency is bad.
It's miserable, and like I don't like John Adams is clearly being a bad guy, and he's being a really bad dad, but in not a particularly fascinating way. It's just sort of like, ugh, you're being a jerk, and I don't want to watch you be a jerk. Mm-hmm. And everybody else's reaction is like, you're being a jerk, and he's like, no, I'm not.
I'm not. I'm doing my best. Jerk.
We can talk about the family stuff first, I guess, just to kind of cover it. And also we started to refer to it a lot in the first half. So, I mean, again, Abigail Adams continues to not have that big of a role in this episode. She kind of has moments where she's like upset with John for being mean, and she's upset with like the effect that things are that or what's happening with their kids. But she doesn't really like stand up to him or give him the business the way that we've seen her do before. So I thought that was kind of weird. And then the big stories here are we have Nabby's husband who used to work for John Adams, who becomes a speculator, who gambles all their money away. And then he basically goes to John Adams and is like, hey, could you help me like get a job? And John Adams is like, no, I'm not going to do that. Sorry, bud. And then the guy's like, what the hell? And he's like, well, you ruined your reputation, so I'm not going to help you do that. And then the guy fairly is like, you know, if you had just helped me get a good job
in the first place.
Right. So it's this kind of like back and forth of, yeah, you're a failure. Well, but it's your fault. Proxy dad. It's like, okay. And so, yeah, then he ghosts his family. And then we also have Charles ghosting his family or being bad to his family. And his wife, like, goes to live with Abigail and John at one point because he's a drunkard. And we have a confrontation where John is like, hey, you're drunk and I disown you. And he's like, Daddy, please, no. Daddy, come back.
It's interesting there briefly that he is like, Dad, curse me. I want you to curse me. Which I think is it's a fairly common thing in folks who are dealing with like really bad addiction or like self-worth issues to be like, yes, it's like a sort of martyrdom complex of like, I want to be thrown on this cross for a bit because it makes me feel vindicated in my mistakes.
Yeah. And it's a form of attention his dad. Cause then as soon as his dad is like, I disown you, he immediately flips and is like, wait, no, please don't leave. It's really sad. And it's probably the worst thing that John Adams does in these episodes is say like, you know, I renounce you. And then he doesn't even go to his son's bedside when he's dying.
And then when he's dead, he's like, well, God save him.
He's like, I still don't forgive him.
Yeah. So the tensions in France continue to build up, in this episode. And it seems like there's going to be some sort of conflict that John is dealing with and stressing about. You had mentioned that one of the things that they're discussing in this episode is something called the XYZ affair, which I'm unfortunately not very familiar with. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So this stretch of time is kind of odd to talk about or teach about because it's basically like, oh, France maybe is gearing up to fight us or something or positioning themselves to, I don't know, like it's this kind of verge of war that never turns into war. It's called the quasi-war with France. And one of the inciting events of that quasi-war is something called the XYZ affair, where basically tensions seem to be rising. And at home, as we see in this episode, John Adams is like, maybe we should have a standing military, you know, and then he's like, okay, well, a diplomatic solution. Let's send some American diplomats over to try to hash things out on back channels. And those American diplomats end up meeting these like French diplomats who are basically like, hey, before you can talk to the person you're going to talk to, like you should give us some money, basically. Like, they asked for a bribe.
Wow.
And it's taken as this, like, huge insult to the United States. It's this big scandal. And then it causes more Americans to be in favor of, like, okay, forget about it. Like, the French have offended us or dishonored us, or they're not respecting our country. They're playing games. So, like, let's fight them, basically.
Okay. And this didn't end up turning into an actual war between the United States and France, did it?
No.
Well, there, yeah. So it sort of sounds like it echoes what, I mean, not like echoes, but so it sounds like it's a little bit similar to sort of the Cold War, where there's tension around these two countries, and now they're worried about fighting with each other.
Yeah. There's definitely some elements of that. And then it just, things continue to get sort of complicated. Basically, America is entangled in the business of, like, Britain and France bouncing off of each other for a couple decades here until we get to, like, the War of 1812.
Mm-hmm.
But for now, nothing really comes of this directly.
Right. It's around this point, I think, that Washington passes away.
Yeah.
Or close to around here.
It, like, kind of happens off screen. It's weird because they're basically talking about this army, and then Adams is, like, decided that Washington's going to lead it, and the dude is, like, probably 70-something at this point or whatever. He's just crusty, and Adams is like, that's what I do. I use Washington to make things seem legitimate. And then he dies, and then it seems like Hamilton was going to be second in command, so ends up being the de facto, like, he was going to be this big general guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get all these conversations where Hamilton is like, oh, yes, I think that the soldiers' uniforms should have 3 stars on them.
And the color like blue this. For the country, like the flag. And you're like, what are you doing?
Yeah, those scenes were funny. And that's another view of Hamilton where it's like, who's this, like, sad, power-grubbing loser?
Right. It's another one of these, like, you can't make a truly unbiased biopic. I don't think that that's possible, but occasionally, like, you look at these two texts in particular, John Adams, HBO, and Hamilton, and you're like, neither of these feel like they're accurately portraying either character. So it's weird. This Hamilton is very power grubby and has, like, really specific quirks. Also, part of that is just in, like, the portrayal from Sewell, who's like always playing this, like, I'm evil kind of guy. I think he, for a couple of years there, was kind of getting typecast as that. And then Mark Strong took on the mantle of the evil man. And then, so one of the other, like, fun recurring sets pieces in this episode is John Adams talking to his two Federalist buddies. One of whom we recognized as Zach Orth, who's in Wet Hot American Summer, a film and a franchise that John and I are very fond of. And these two guys, the scene where he fires both of them, is pretty big on YouTube. It has, like, that's one of the most viewed clip scenes of the show on YouTube. And it's not that, like, dramatically exciting. Basically, the first scene with all three of them is like, hey, Hamilton, like, we think, or not Hamilton, sorry, hey, John Adams, like, we think, you know, this France stuff is going to get really serious. You need to, like, take a stand. And he's like, I commit to the impartiality that, like, Washington told me to do. And they're like, well, okay, that's going to probably go badly for you. And then we cut to a couple months later, I guess, and they're much more aggressive with him. And this is, like, the very rare moment where Adams, like, really asserts his position as president. And they're like, you're making a terrible mistake. You're such a fool. And he's like, cool. Give me your resignations. And you're like, oh shit. He's the president now. It's like this moment of like power.
Yeah.
From Adams.
I really like the pursed lips guy.
the other guy.
Every time you look at him, he's like doing a little kissy face. Mm-hmm. He's like, come on, do the Alien Sedition Act, please.
Come on.
And then, yeah, the Zach Orth thing, I was like, who is this guy? I don't know.
Very much
you
like,
are.
I know you.
So weird to see him in, like, a serious role where he's doing a thick accent.
Thick, like, Scottish accent.
Yeah.
He sounds like the Scotsman from Samurai Jack or something.
Right.
So the Alien Act, that's the one that's like no foreigners. No, we're trying not to leave to get the French. I'm gonna give my like my super Spark Notes version.
Go for it.
Alien Act is the one that's like we're afraid of the French and we don't want any French evil nasty spies in our country, so we won't let them in. And then the Sedition Acts are the ones that's like nobody say anything bad about the government ever. No, and you can't print it. It's illegal. You'll go to prison.
Yeah.
That's fairly accurate.
That's correct, yeah. Because the idea is like I think something that this episode gets right, and probably my favorite aspect of it that just gets muddled by all the other stuff, is how the workings of like faction and party politics basically totally screw with the Federalist set of priorities, because they're not saying things that are about like good governance, these guys that are whispering in John Adams' ear. Instead, it's all about like, how do we make sure that the Federalists stay in power? And if you're a political party and you're the incumbent, how do you stay in power? Well, you start a war. And then that means that people will vote you back in because they want to keep you around. And what does a war allow you to do? It allows you to control who comes in and out of the country. It allows you to control what's said about the government.
It allows you to control things like where funds are going and redirect funds towards whatever you think is quote unquote contributing to the war effort, stuff like that.
Yeah. So it's sort of wild to think that, you know, we are on president number two and already we see the kinds of strategies and approaches that you'll see enacted by like Woodrow Wilson's government in World War One when they passed the Espionage Act, or like things that feel reminiscent of the Patriot Act, right?
Yeah, yes.
And so in a way, this kind of feels like a an emphasis that's being made in the HBO series because it's like a post 9/11 John Adams series.
Yeah.
And like John Adams' story, you can definitely read, and they certainly would have been conscious of those connections.
I mean, that book came out in 01, remember?
Yeah, right. So that's true. The biography came out in 01. Yeah, I think that those themes are really interesting, and you know, it's cool to watch the Federalist guys advocate for those things and see how it's about maintaining their power. And also when you think about like something like the Sedition Act, you know, who are the people, this is what I like to ask in class. It's like, who are the people that are most likely saying things that are bad about the Federalist government? It's
Republicans.
Right. It's the Republicans. It's their political rivals. So like if you have a law that says like now we can shut down your newspaper if you say bad things about the government, you know, you're shutting down all these Republican newspapers. Because at the time, there weren't necessarily like national objective publications.
Not that there are now, but.
Well, but there weren't publications that necessarily aspired to that either.
Yes. Yes. They're more partisan at the time.
Yeah, they're like, you know, newspapers that brand themselves as like being Federalist newspapers.
Or the Republicans Daily or like the, right. You know, the Federalist papers. No, obviously not.
And then the other thing with the Alien Act is like if you're controlling who comes in and out of the country, you know, like you could say, oh, don't let in any immigrants from France because they could be spies. But also, you know, the thing underneath that is that those people tend to be voters for the Republican Party as opposed to the Federalists. So
exactly.
It's another angle to that as well. And then I also thought it was interesting that Abigail Adams is a proponent of the Alien and Sedition Acts. I found that hard to square. And I'm wondering, I guess that must be true. I feel like they wouldn't just make that up. But it seems like that maybe... at least the way that they're framing it in this is that that's coming from a place of like, they kind of trivialize it in this where she is like upset about the things that they're saying about her husband in the newspaper.
Like they're calling him various slurs.
The word
that they use is now considered like a pretty bad slur for intersex people, but they use that and they refer to him and they're like referring to Washington and all this stuff. It's honestly a lot more vile than even like in when they were back from France and everyone's like, John Adams is fat, stupid. Now it's like much more targeted attacks to his character, you know?
And I think it's Hamilton who's writing it, or maybe it's Jefferson or both of them. Like
Hamilton at one point does write a slanderous piece towards him. Yes, sorry.
Yeah, they all said some pretty nasty stuff about each other in the papers. But yeah, it seems at least they're framing it as her being like, I don't like what they're saying about you, John. And John Adams is like, it's fine. It's okay. I'm above it all, which is a weird framing. I think it's also just that Abigail Adams is like, you know, wants law and order maybe more than we'd care to admit. So that's something to consider as well.
Well, it's, I also think, to be honest, that they will, like, especially in this episode, they'll shift and adjust Abigail's character and her beliefs according to what is dramatically appropriate.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, there's that's when they first get to the White House, she has that line where she's like, huh, half-fed slaves building our nation's capital. What possible good can come from such a place? And it's like your entire, like your husband's whole career was built on the backs of enslaved people. This country was built on their backs. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, suddenly you're deciding
right,
that like
you have to look at it. You're like, ooh.
Ooh, they're here. Like they're actually in front of us. Like this is bad. Like come
I
on.
I mean, she did like rib Washington earlier, remember when she met
yes.
him?
About him was it about him owning enslaved people?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, yeah, but it's always been kind of like a casual thing for her. Like she's not doing anything about it really. She's just sort of like, oh, this is deplorable.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this show you can even read as like sort of neoliberal like backpatting. You know, one of the parts in that or aforementioned like Federalist him firing his two guys scene, one of the parts in that that people like to quote is he's like, a president that rules by fear is no president at all. And like every Democrat boring person in the comments is like, tell that to Donald Trump, guys. Come on. It's like, you're right. You are right. That's like it's a good point. But it just feels very like we're feeding the mouths of like people who want to be told that like the president is being mean or being bad compared to his previous one. I don't know. That was just my take. But yeah, so we talked about all the Charles death stuff. It's really sad, honestly. And, you know, it feels like by the end of this episode, John is ready to just relinquish his position in office once and for all. He's tired. He's old. He's barely kept the country together. The handoff to Jefferson was a little confusing to me. I know, like, you know, classic chat second episode syndrome. I'm like tuning out by this point of the episode, but it seems basically like, well, Jefferson is the next smartest guy and people still like him and he never got to be president. That vote just kind of goes to him by default. I was a little unclear on like what led to Jefferson becoming president, I guess.
So what ends up happening, Jefferson runs in 1796, which is when Adams wins. And Jefferson got like second place in that election.
By three votes or whatever.
Yeah. And so what ends up happening at this point in time is the guy who's in first place is the president and the guy who's in second place is the vice president.
Yes.
Partway through his vice presidency, Jefferson is like, I'm just going to go home. And he like goes and
go back to Monticello. And
yeah. And like, hey, if you holler, if you need me, he's like basically absent from the Adams administration, despite technically being the vice president. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he ever resigns. I think as far as I know, he's the vice president through the whole term. Then it's 1800 and people are running for president again. Adams runs for a second term. He ends up falling behind Burr and Jefferson, if not somebody else too, I'm not sure. Burr and Jefferson are both Republicans, so they split the Republican Party vote.
Mm-hmm.
And they tie in the Electoral College. So what happens when that happens, when either somebody doesn't win by, you know, a majority or whatever, or there's a tie, that goes to Congress to decide. And so in the musical Hamilton, the way that this is portrayed is the part where it's like, Jefferson or Burr, you know, choose Jefferson. And it's that framed part. As if like Hamilton is the one that basically tells the Federalists what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, Jefferson's a better guy, so don't vote for Burr, which is, you know, an exaggeration, I think, and centers Hamilton in the story.
Of course.
Here, there's an implication that maybe John Adams influences it in one way or the other. But Jefferson comes to talk to him and it's like, hey, buddy. And Adams is like, hey, Mr. President. And the guy playing Jefferson does like this great little wave. Like, don't call me president right now. Mm-hmm. please. And what they talk about there is Jefferson says they still haven't decided. Congress basically takes votes over like 30 different times.
Whoa.
To try to figure out Burr or Jefferson who's going to be president, and they keep either drawing or they're not being a big enough majority, so they have to keep doing the vote over and over and over again until finally Jefferson ends up winning and becoming the third president. So
okay.
It's definitely not like an automatic process. It's like a very, very close race, and Burr could have very easily been the third president. So that's why Burr is Jefferson's vice president, because he ends up being in second place.
Mm-hmm. So I think that then is like, that's really valuable information to know, and I wish I came into this episode knowing that, because the episode doesn't portray anything that you just described, at least not like in any detail. And obviously, like, most of that's not happening in front of John, and he's the center. So
this episode definitely was the one where I was watching it and I was like, I don't know what you could get from this if you don't already know the history of what's going on.
Okay, so you felt that too then? Yeah, I'm like,
yeah, it was just that one passing comment from Jefferson. Like, there's the part where they read the votes. Hamilton reads the votes, or somebody reads it to him. And then Abigail's like, hey, you did an okay job, even though you lost. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then Jefferson comes in and he's like, they're voting right now. But like, unless you're paying very close attention and already know the history, you blink and you miss the reference to that. Because it's not Jefferson's story. So I think that's kind of why they don't really care about explaining it to you.
So I want to get back to that talking about Jefferson's story thing, but before I do, we can get to the end of this episode. So again, John is really, he's very old now. He's happy to be out of office. He's in the White House with one of his guys talking to him, and the guy's like, yeah, Jefferson won. And he's like, inauguration is soon. And he's like, cool. I'm not going, by the way. And the guy's like, why? And he's like, I'm too tired. Don't feel like going. And the great dramatic touch, and I think this is so good, especially for Giamatti to play this, is he's throwing papers into the fireplace, mm-hmm. and just very quietly he's doing it. And then one of the papers he puts in, he goes, oh, no, oh, not that one. Oh, no. Oh, mm-hmm. And he's like, so he's old enough that he can't like rush to get it. So he like takes it out and steps on it, but mm-hmm. it's ruined. He's like, I wasn't supposed to burn that one. Oh, and it's just like this background flavor to the scene, this like accoutrement that you don't need, that just shows that like, yeah, Adams is truly checked out now. Like, not necessarily entirely due to old age, but he's been doing a lot. He's really old and ready to kind of retire to Peacefield once and for all.
Mm-hmm.
He's even smoking a lot more. I think that was another like touch that I noticed, was he's smoking a lot between every time he like gets roasted by the newspapers, and then here he's just like sitting and like smoking into camera basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm really curious what you thought of the final scene of this episode, where John Adams has packed all of his things and he's being moved out of the White House, and he's loaded onto a carriage full of other people, and he sits right in the center of this carriage, and everybody's staring at him because it's John Adams, former president of the United States, and he says, "Stop gawking. I'm plain John Adams, ordinary citizen, just as yourself, mm-hmm. just as yourselves." And then the carriage just like slowly pulls away from the White House, and the music fades in, and that's the end of the episode. And it's like, I guess it's straight down the pitch, you know, like he's tired, he's done, he wants to go back to his life. I think that works dramatically, but it also just like doesn't feel like a very satisfying dramatic ending to his presidency, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the point that the episode is trying to make overall is essentially trying to like reclaim some sense of respect for John Adams. Like, yeah. Hey, look, he made a hard choice. He chose peace over party. Like, he could have easily done the Federalist warmongering thing that all the Federalists wanted him to do, but instead he used his diplomatic experience. He like teamed up with his cool sons and he made peace happen. And that's not flashy or sexy, but it's awesome. And then the thanks that he got was that he got his ass kicked out of office and he didn't get any respect. And he, you know, kind of returned to this humble life of obscurity. So I think that's kind of what the episode is going for. But I think also, and I don't know how to feel about that. I think that that's interesting. And then I think also kind of what that scene is trying to do, where he's like, look at me, I'm just humble, plain old John Adams, is he's so prideful as a person. And he, like, I think that's the moment where it really hits him of like, I'm not president anymore.
He's telling himself as much as he's telling these people, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. Like, he's processing it, and he's like, the story of my life's accomplishments is over. Like, I've done all of the things that I was going to do. And so now it's sort of up to you, the viewer, to decide, you know.
What do you think about my presidency?
Yeah, how great was it? Because at this point now, I'm just like a normal guy. And there's nothing else for me to aspire to. And there's no place for me anymore in this like world of politics, basically.
Yeah, this is all going to go on beyond me. I always find it so fascinating when I look at the list of the first, like, you know, five or six presidents. And it's like all of these guys were alive at the same time and knew each other and were just like in the same very small elitist circle of government. And they just like passed on president from person to person. But everybody did something really special and important to their own like story. And, you know, why choose John Adams amongst all of those? You right. could have chosen any of those. You know, this right. could have been.
Yeah.
Going back to the point from previously, this could have been a George Washington story, like following the military stuff mm-hmm. and gone way more action-y, or, you know, take it to the Jefferson story and like give us Monticello and like give us the dark version of his story. Mm-hmm. Heck, we're going to see John Quincy Adams get president, hopefully, by the end of the series. So like, because he does that within John's lifetime. Mm-hmm. There's so much like narrative potential. And then John is just this like one guy who you're like, oh, really? Like the guy that no one liked? The one that like everyone hated? But I think it really is like a role that Paul Giamatti was born to play, because it was for a while at least sort of typecast as that beleaguered, exhausted, why are you mean to me? Why can't people help me out kind of guy? Mm-hmm. So it works for him. Like I think it's just one of the best pieces of casting I've seen.
Yeah, I think that he's a great choice for the role.
For sure. There was actually a scene we can compare to this last scene that we didn't talk about, but was in both of our notes, where he goes to see a play with Abigail. And
holy
it's
shit,
this
scene.
So this is, we didn't talk much about the directing in these episodes, because it's really just settled into like Tom Hooper loves his Dutch angles. Mm-hmm. But extra here in this like theater scene, we have the camera crawling its way up people's legs in the theater. We have it panning, like handheld panning, Dutch angles all across the board.
Yeah,
this is
like freaking almost 90 degrees. It was crazy.
It's a nauseating scene.
Yeah.
It really boils down to like John is not used to the way that people are treating him, and like he's like coming to terms with it.
Yeah, I think the scene serves a perfectly good narrative function in the sort of thing I was describing just now, which is like this is the first time that he's ever been popular. Yeah. Really is when he comes into the theater and the guy's like, you're gonna fight the French and like kill them with Thomas Jefferson's jawbone, and everyone's like, heck yeah, woo,
three cheers,
go to war, we love you. And it's this kind of intoxicating thing for him that really causes him to make some bad decisions, and ultimately almost causes him to make a terrible decision of going to war. But it just looks so dumb.
It's nauseating to look at.
Really stupid.
The song they're singing, by the way, I looked into it. It's called Hail Columbia. Columbia is like what they would call, it's like the idealized version of America. This was almost the national anthem before the Star Spangled Banner was written, which was written, I think, a little bit after this whole situation.
Mm-hmm. It was written during the War of 1812.
Yep. So at this time, it's like, this is the national anthem. We're singing it for him. It's this very triumphant, like, America has so much infinite potential and we're reaching it and here we go. And it is now, like, if you read the Wikipedia page for it, it's like, Hail Columbia was, you know, written as the old, like, national anthem before it was replaced. It is now used as the entrance march for the vice president.
Isn't it?
The ultimate John Adams story is like, and then the vice president. That's what we know you for.
That's funny.
Yeah, but good stuff. And yeah, so he goes off into the sunset to live out his days in Peacefield. John Adams Esquire. I'm really curious about this last episode, man. I didn't think I would still have momentum in me after these two, because this is honestly like the hump. But you know, seeing, getting to watch very old Paul Giamatti makeup, getting to see John Quincy older, getting to see the kids again, and him and Abigail. Like, this is the character stuff you want. Mm-hmm. My favorite, like, dramatic arc is, like, you know, rising action, climax, and then the falling action, like, denouement chapter being the last episode or last chapter is always my favorite shit, where, like, the big battle, and what if you want to call this the big battle, yeah, happens in episode 6, and episode 7 is, like, and then we have peace for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So we'll be talking about that one next week as we conclude our discussion of John Adams' HBO.
Yeah.
John, do you want to read me a summary of what happens in Peacefield?
Sure. I would love to. By the way, I think it's a little historical tidbit. I've been furiously trying to do research to confirm this, and I don't know for sure. But the scene where John Adams is like, has all the documents and he's burning some of them and stuff.
Yeah.
It was a moment like basically the day before Jefferson gets inaugurated, Adams appoints all of these judges like the night before and then gets the Senate to approve them really quickly. Uh-huh. Jefferson basically refuses or tells James Madison, who becomes a Secretary of State, like, don't send those letters to those judges, making them judges. And then one of those guys who's supposed to be a judge is named William Marbury, and he sues the government and is like, hey, you're supposed to make me a judge. Huh. And then the case Marbury v. Madison comes out of that, which is the case that establishes the Supreme Court's power to do judicial review.
Whoa.
And I think, I don't know if this is true, because I don't know what he's meant to be burning here, like if he's meant to be burning a paper trail related to that or what. But I think the gag might be that he's accidentally burning Marbury's letter.
Oh my himself. God.
And then he's like, whoops, I didn't mean to burn that one.
Oh my God.
I think that's the joke they're doing. Or maybe it's just a joke about like, whoops, I didn't mean to burn that. But I think that's what's going on there.
That's hilarious if that's the case.
Yeah. But what I couldn't confirm that anywhere, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Anyway, so next time we are going to be watching the final episode of HBO's John Adams miniseries, episode 7, which is called Peacefield. In retirement, Adams starts writing his memoirs, then endures a series of tragedies when his daughter dies of cancer, and a few years later, Abigail succumbs to typhoid fever. At the urging of Dr. Rush, Adams reports the sad news to Jefferson, with the two old friends and adversaries taking solace in a correspondence that mends old wounds.
Aww, I'm going to cry.
That just
probably
sounds like cute old men, yeah. And then the thumbnail on HBO Max is he's putting shingles on his roof.
That's cute. Ultimate dad life. He finally gets
very
to be the dad.
Cute. Can you imagine if you had to put shingles?
Individual shingles on your house?
Individual shingles, yeah.
Bananas. Couldn't be me. God. I can barely put individual shingles
on my feet.
Yeah, exactly. Good job. You really picked that one up.
Shugles.
They like overplay Dr. Benjamin Rush in this series as like, I don't know how close friends he was with Adams, but basically whenever they need John Adams to be like, all right, what's the news? They just put Rush in the scene to be like, all right, so people hate you. Yeah, I think that it's just funny.
I think he's one of those guys who was like big at the time but has kind of been forgotten among all of his peers who were presidents, kind of thing.
Right, always the bridesmaid, never the bride, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think it's time, Mr. Magellan, to take it to the plug zone.
Let's do it.
Do you want to do this one?
Sure. So if you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can do so in whatever way you like. You can do so via email. We're at chatspod@gmail.com. You can do so on Twitter, following us, twitter.com/chatspod, where you can also direct message us if you would like. And then if you would like to get in touch with the squad, with the fellow chatsies, you can go over to reddit.com/r/chatspod, where they're over there watching and listening to old chat seasons. I believe they're still on our first season, Scape Chats, by the time this comes out, but they're nearing the end of it. So, you know, it's now or never to get involved in that. But yeah, get in touch with us. Let us know what you think of the show. Give us some suggestions for things you want us to watch. If you'd like to be on the show, we love to have listeners just come on. It's an open door policy here, basically. So yeah, let us know. And then if you'd like to review the show to help other people find it, we would really appreciate that. If you go over to iTunes, give us a 5-star review, please, please, please.
Please.
We're hoping to do a push, a listener push for when we start season 9 in a couple weeks. So getting more people on board is the name of the game. And if you'd like to support the show and you don't already, you can do so over at patreon.com/chatspod, where you can back the show at one of 3 different tiers. At $1 a month, you can $1 a month. Think about how little money that is. I lose $1 a month under the freaking cushions. Anyway.
I can't even afford cushions.
$1 a month. You can get access to some of our commentary chats backlog, where we watched some movies back in the day for $1 a month. And you can also get access to just things that are available to all patrons, some random fun files, my coverage of the X-Files called the Chats Files, all sorts of stuff. At $3 a month, you get access to everything new, 3 bonus episodes at least a month. It's still the month of September, so at this point, you've heard a Chats Nights where we play AI Dungeon. You've heard a Pilot Chats where we pilot 4 different sitcoms from 2009. And you've heard a Chats Nights where we just kind of hang out and have fun and vibe. And then at $5 a month, you just get the whole backlog, the whole shebang. And it's the money you lose under 5 cushions. So
5 cushions, $5, 5 podcasts.
Right. So come on now. But that's that. And then instead of personal plugs at the end here, we like to do little chatsums, little things that you can snack on between now and next time that you watch a show with us and listen to us talk about a show. Alan, what is your chatsum for this week?
Well, now my first chatsum has to be the little bit of English that you put on that little snack on over there. That was really kinky.
Thank you. Thank you. This is my voice actor reel right now.
Excellent. Excellent. I haven't chatsumed an activity in a while, but this past week, something that's helped me a lot with like focusing and getting work done in various parts of my life is just throwing on music, but specifically like, when I was a toddler, my mom would always play like Beethoven and classical music for us, like on a little disc or on a cassette in our bedroom, my sister and I. And now I can still listen to classical music and it helps me focus, but there's so much. And sometimes, you know, I want to listen to New Job Bass, except New Job Bass isn't alive anymore and he's not making music. So I want some other like kind of chill music to listen to. And if you have been on YouTube for any period of time, I'm sure you've run into the lo-fi hip-hop community on there. This kind of all sprouted out from a YouTube channel called Chilled Cow, who is actually running a... Nothing but shout-outs to Chilled Cow. A 24/7 playlist video called Lo-Fi Hip-Hop Radio Beats to Relax /Study 2. It's like a meme at this point. It's iconic. It's famous. Literally at this moment, 32,000 people have it open. It's huge. But if you watch that for any period of time and you're like, wow, this is so nice and relaxing and I'm so focused, your YouTube recommendations will be flooded with like different types of chill playlists, 80 minutes of Nintendo elevator music, 3 a.m. study session, Japanese drive when jazz drive when driving on a warm night, just all this like good, very cool, specific mood music that I just love. And I think you might discover something in there that you love too. So yeah, just go ahead, just go down the lo-fi hip-hop hole on YouTube. It's a lot of fun. And nice. It's very relaxing. But John, what about you?
I have a couple.
Wow.
Couple chatsums.
He's got several, everyone.
The first is a TV show that we've piloted over on our Patreon a while ago. I want to say last year, maybe. Mm-hmm. And that show is Malcolm in the Middle. I've been watching Malcolm in the Middle from the beginning. It's so good. It's funny. It's creative, like visually very creative show. And a lot more, there's a lot more, I don't know if edge is the right word, but it's definitely a lot more like, surreal sometimes than maybe you remember it being. Cause I think I was talking to my roommate about it. And he remembers it as like, oh, that's like a normal family sitcom. And it's like, no, this Malcolm's a little, it's a little sideways from that. So it's definitely worth watching. If you're looking for something that's just like throw it on, enjoy it, and do something else at the same time.
I haven't stopped thinking about the scene you sent me about Egg. I love it. I embrace it. I want to be part of that.
Yeah, people should look up Malcolm in the Middle Egg. There was one particularly bizarre side character that I was like wheezing laughing. It was so funny.
Once I watched it a couple times, I hit the point where I could just whisper the word egg to myself and start cracking up all over again. It's like I don't know. It's magical. I need to watch more Malcolm in the Middle, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth it. And then in line with that, I was looking for, is there a currently running Malcolm in the Middle podcast out there that I can throw on and listen to and vibe to? And there is. It's called Life is Unfair. And it's two hosts who've known each other for quite a long time. I think they might be cousins. And if they're not cousins, they're best friends from childhood.
Ooh.
One of them's a teacher.
What the?
They both really love Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
What the? Is this litigious? Hello?
There was a whole bit where there was a character watching a Buffy episode off screen, and one of the hosts went through the work of researching exactly what Buffy episode the clip was from so that they could put that information on the IMDb trivia.
And then they did it.
Like, okay, these people are legit. I'm into it. So Life is Unfair is a great companion to Malcolm in the Middle. And then the last thing is I've just been kind of bopping around YouTube for months at this point. I keep having YouTube chatsums because of it, but my particular rabbit hole this week, I've seen Bill Wirtz's videos before. I've seen the I'm a piece of garbage, that one, or like I've seen History of Japan or, you know, the,
have you seen History
ones.
Of the World?
I had seen parts of it and I watched the whole thing this week. Yeah.
So good.
Really good. And then but I didn't know that he also had like just full length songs.
Yeah.
And so I've been listening to Bill Wirtz songs on Spotify, and they're delightful. They're really quite nice, little earworms, so I recommend it. There's one particular song called Might Quit, which is his most recent one from like a year ago, and that's a really, really fun one.
It was the last song on his channel and it's called Might Quit, and you're like, no.
Yeah,
but it's a really good song, so it's worth it. Love Bill Wirtz. Big fan. Videos, music, all of the above. Cool. Well, Magellan, this has been a really fun episode. Thank you, as always, for being the rock to my heart place. I know I say it every week, but I do miss you very much, and I love you, and I appreciate your companionship and your wisdom on the podcast. And thank you very much, dear listener, for listening and hopefully enjoying this episode of Chats Adams. Long live the king.